It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hey, what's up? It's Will Kane of the Will Kane Podcast. Today, we have a fascinating conversation with the former brand president of Levi's. Levi's, of course, is the denim company, the jeans company that you probably at least at some point in your life had grown to love. I know that I did. I wore 517s and 527s bootcut for most of my life. And Jennifer Say made news about a year and a half ago when she posted a column up at Barry Weiss's Substack, Common Sense, announcing her resignation from Levi's because she felt like woke capitalism and groupthink had attempted to censor her voice when it came to school closures during COVID. It's a fascinating behind-the-scenes conversation based upon a new book she has out called Levi's Unbuttoned. Go check it out. Levi's Unbuttoned. It's on sale now, where you can hear this story, which again is a fascinating insight into the way that corporate America works, how it is virtually leaderless, how it runs in fear of the mob, and whether or not companies can take philosophical or brand stances, or should they be purely profit-driven capitalist enterprises. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jennifer Say. Jennifer Say, I'm so glad to have you today here on the Will Kane Podcast. It's nice to see you again. I'm trying to think where I want to begin our conversation, and I hope I characterize this correctly. So I think the place that I want to start is just asking you, was there a moment? Was there a breaking point? When did you realize? When did you see the light? When was there a conversion that you went from, in your own words, in your book, Levi's Unbuttoned, from being a wokester to where you are today?
Well, it certainly happened during my final 2 years at Levi's. I mean, I from the very beginning in March 2020, from the beginning of the COVID lockdowns and school closures, I was pushing back. I was against it from the very beginning, especially in terms of the harms that would be done to children from long-term school closures, which we've now seen actually play out. I would say in the spring, I wasn't rejecting the Democratic Party and wokeness outright at that point. But by the fall, when the private schools in San Francisco opened and the public schools were closed, and my peers who had their kids in school in private were telling me I had to stop talking about this, that for me was a no going back moment. That was a, you don't care about any of this. It's all a pose. It's all a pretense. And the reason when I raised it and suggested that perhaps we weigh in as a company on closed public schools in San Francisco, the reason I was given for not doing so is that it would look bad because their kids were in private, which says to me, it's all a lie. All of these stances that we take, it's all a lie, so that you can present this certain image, burnish this sort of, it's reputation laundering in a sense, right? Polish this nice image and do whatever you want underneath the covers in the dark of night. And I think, you know, there's broader implications than just the school closures. But for me, that was the real eye opener. I mean, we see it right now with this latest guy, this FTX guy, what's his name? Sam Bankman-Fried. Who was very similar to Elizabeth Holmes, to the WeWork guy, Adam Neumann. They put forth this image, this pose of culty, we're going to change the world. There's no financial stability underneath what they're presenting. At the end of the day, it was a con, right? They're con artists. They lied. They took a lot of money from investors. But because they put forth this woke image of saving the world, it was excused and we all sort of uncovered it far too late. And I should say the press supports it, and that's a huge problem.
Wow, what a corollary. You draw SBF,
Sank
Bankman Friedman, and FTX together with Theranos, and corporate branding, virtue signaling, even individual on Twitter, and then to the extent of corporate branding, laundering a reputation through virtue signaling to continue to make cash registers ring. Before that realization, and I think you are absolutely right in drawing these corollaries, I mean, it may run the gamut from criminal in the case of FTX to simply fraudulent in the case of, I would assume you would make in the case of Levi's. But before you had this realization, as you were there, you were the brand president of Levi's. What was the brand of Levi's before, to you, it began to be exposed as nothing more than a pose?
Yeah, I mean, in my wildest hopes and dreams, this is a brand and a company that kind of returns to the core values that they espouse but are not living up to, in my opinion. There's a long history at the company of doing right by employees. I think that's great. That's the right thing to do. You know, a few examples: they integrated factories in the 50s, long before the law required it. They offered same-sex partner benefits in 1992, first Fortune 500 company to do so. You could argue these are woke poses, but not really, because they're about taking care of employees and offering equality to employees. It's when that pivots to the external message and is the main thing you're selling that I think it becomes problematic, because what you're selling is a product. You know, you're selling a product that should work in the case of Elizabeth Holmes, and it did not work, right? We sell jeans at Levi's. People love the jeans. I don't know that they're buying the values. It's all a pretense and it's a lie. And I would say there's a continuum here, because you have, as you pointed out, there's FTX, which is criminal. Holmes, that was criminal too, we now know, right? She's been convicted on 4 counts of fraud. Newman, not criminal, but a scammer. For sure, a scammer. And then you have woke CEOs across, I don't even know how many companies, and I'll give you an example from Levi's. Our CEO, under the cover of COVID, laid off 15% of the workforce, said we were doing it with empathy. That bolstered the stock price, and he cashed out $42 million worth of stock. Now, the empathetic thing to do would have been to find a way to have these folks keep their jobs, maybe to advocate for things to open so that we could keep people employed. That's not what we did. So there's a, it runs a gamut, but it's all to sort of conceal that business is always, is as it's always been. It's about making money and it's about delivering profit. Now, sometimes those profits are earned. Sometimes in the case of FTX, there's fraudulence and real criminality. But there shouldn't be anything shameful about saying we're a business, we're here to deliver a great product at a fair price, we treat our employees fairly, and we're in this to do business. What's wrong with that?
You described in your book this transition or this transformation of Levi's. It kind of, in a way, I think mirrored some of your maybe personal transformation, although you didn't take the full journey that did Levi's. And it was one, as you mentioned, of inclusivity, of expanding the brand to more people, to when it inverted on itself and it became a philosophy of exclusion. And that obviously was most prevalent when it came to viewpoint exclusion or even political exclusion. It was fine for you. Yeah. You think it would have been fine for you to criticize Donald Trump. It wasn't cool for you to criticize Gavin Newsom. Do you think you mentioned your former CEO, and I want to go in on all of these different angles, this journey for Levi's and for yourself in just a moment, but I'm always fascinated by this. And I've wondered why so much spinelessness when it comes to CEOs, you know, and I've talked about, you know, running in fear of your employees, running in fear of Twitter. You actually forwarded a really fascinating one that I hadn't thought about in your book, which is CEOs afraid of their own children.
I think so. I think that's part of it. I don't think that's all of it. But I wrote about it pretty extensively in the book that, you know, it's no longer enough for CEOs to be super duper wealthy, which they are. They all also want to be celebrated as altruists and heroes. And, you know, as with the case with this latest FTX guy, that's enough to conceal the fact that they're not even running a real business. I think part of the reason they want to be celebrated as such, it's this whole I'm not your dad, I'm your friend thing with your kids. And they have these kids who were raised in very woke private schools, who were raised by helicopter parents with this sort of extreme safetyism. So any sort of affront is a social justice crime, you know, if they're insulted for even a second. And I think the kids feel guilty about the fact that they were raised with so much money. And so they're sort of burnishing these woke bona fides as well. And I think the CEOs want to impress their own kids. It's not enough that they've given them every advantage any child could ever have. That's not enough. And in fact, they feel guilty about it. And they want to be seen as heroes by their own children and their kids' cohort. And those folks are populating these companies now, these young, very outspoken, very online kids. And I think they're afraid of them because they don't really understand social media. They don't understand it's real, but it's also not, and things pass quickly. And I think ultimately it's a sort of simple answer. I sort of think they just lack the moral courage to say enough.
I think you're exactly right. And I love what you said in there about it's a generation of parenting based upon I'm not your dad, I'm your buddy. And then what that means is as those children start to enter, we'll call it extended adolescence, maybe early adulthood, it is the parent then seeking the acceptance of the child and then therefore taking on or attempting to please those very modern views of society and lacking the moral courage to really honestly believe in themselves, those CEOs.
Yeah, I mean, every generation since forever, aren't the parents at one point considered, you know, once the kids grow up, hopelessly sort of lame and uncool? But we all used to accept that, right? Like, I thought that about my parents when I came home from college and thought I knew everything. But my parents weren't trying to convince me otherwise. They're like, no, I'm your mom. I'm your dad. This is what you're going to do. That doesn't seem to be what's happening. There seems to be a sort of different generational relationship here. I don't know why. I don't know why that's changed. I think part of it is, you know, as I think about this out loud, I'm Gen X. My generation was known sort of as the latchkey generation. I was not a latchkey kid, but I think broadly speaking, my generation felt ignored by our parents. You know, our parents got divorced in droves. They latchkeyed us into the house at you know, age 8, 9. And so broadly, we've responded to that by saying, we're not going to ignore our children. We're going to manage every aspect of their lives to within an inch of their lives. And we overdo it. And we don't give them room to make mistakes. And we try to please them and we want to be their friend. We don't want them to feel ignored as our generation did. Not in every instance, but in many. I think in many ways that broadly defines my generation.
And I think it accurately describes so many CEOs. Tell me about the role in your story, your personal story, I think. But I think your story, as we all know, has come to be symbolic of something much larger in corporate America. Tell me the role when it comes to this issue and your main issue. And we're going to go into other ones, I hope, here in a moment. But your main issue was COVID response, particularly school closures. But tell me the role when it came to any of this angst inside of Levi's of Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, that's just the sort of go-to insult for anyone who defies whatever the Democratic orthodoxy of the moment is or whatever the woke, you're a Trumper. It's like you step one little tiny step outside of whatever the Democratic orthodoxy is or was. And in the case of COVID restrictions, the only humane thing to do was to lock everybody down. That was the selfless, virtuous thing to do. Keep kids home, alone, isolated. If you didn't think that, if you thought that was wrong and that would create harm, you were a Trumper. You were also a racist. You were anti-trans. You were anti-fat. You were every bad thing you could be, every horrible, unemployable name. And what this serves to do is keep most people silent. That's the real problem in all of this, is that demonization prevented us from having a societal conversation, a rational and well-reasoned conversation, for instance, about schools and restrictions on kids. If we'd had that, we would have inevitably reached a different answer than the one that we reached in my state, my ex-state of California, because it was clear that this was going to do tremendous catastrophic harm and that it wasn't going to save anybody from COVID. But that's what's so alarming to me is the silencing, the demonizing. I mean, there was nothing worse you could be called than a Trumper. And I was called that repeatedly. It doesn't matter that I didn't vote for the man. It doesn't matter that I was critical of him in the past. Truth doesn't matter. It's anything to keep you quiet, to shut you up. That's the strategy.
And I don't think it's necessarily important, but perhaps a matter of curiosity. It's one that you deal with in the, I think, opening pages of your book. You are a pro-choice, lifelong Democrat. And I think that's only interesting to the listener or viewer today as a matter of context. And you know, when you point out, like, okay, you were called racist or transphobic, to me, that just illustrates the sort of, you know, virtue signaling bucket that the entire crackerjack box of policies you had to embrace was lumped. But the Trump thing was particularly interesting to me because you were called Trumpian by everyone, it seemed like, including your own CEO, dismissively, not thoughtfully, dismissively, whatever your position was Trumpian. And as you explained, both what was going on in the public discourse and internally at Levi's, it also just illustrated to me how reactionary it all was. Illustrated to me, if Donald Trump had been for school closures, everyone in your social sphere and at Levi's would have been opposed to school closures.
You're 100% correct. And I do want to say I'm not a Democrat anymore.
Okay.
I have seen the hypocrisy and I cannot unsee it. I have not rushed into the arms of the Republicans either. I am unaffiliated. I join a large group of unaffiliated voters in Colorado, 40% of us. So I'm going to vote according to the issues that I care about. I don't care what party you're from. But yeah, it's a knee-jerk response. And you're absolutely right. And I think I lay it out in the book. There was discussion about schools needing to open in the fall by Democratic leaders, by the American Academy of Pediatrics. They recommended it. Then a week later, Trump and Betsy DeVos had some sort of meeting and they said schools need to open. And guess what? Everybody changed their mind. The American Academy of Pediatrics changed their mind. Democratic leaders. Everything was reflexive. But the part that I still find a bit confusing, I thought as all of that was happening, that was about getting to November, to the election, and that as soon as if Biden won, which he did, it would all sort of go away and we would be free to get back to doing what was right for kids, but it didn't. And they continue to double down. And in fact, there's still mask mandates. And when mask mandates are discussed, they're only ever discussed at this point for schools. Like, I don't understand why children are the locus of all of this restricting and anxiety. It makes no sense. Nobody's talking about mask mandates in bars. I haven't heard that. Have you? I haven't heard it. I only hear it being debated for schools. But I think what happened is the genie was just out of the bottle. The hysteria was just out of the bottle. And even if the plan was to turn it off after November, there was no way to do it. And so these Democratic leaders continue to double down on these failed policies. They just were. And I hold them responsible. Gavin Newsom kept kids out of school for 18 months while his own children went to private school.
Which is absolutely unforgivable. Absolutely unforgivable, much less something that one could endorse at the ballot box. I could express my own passion on this. I mean, that level of, I don't even care about the hypocrisy, that level of malevolence demands accountability. But I'm curious how do you explain, and maybe this is a segue for you and I to get into a few other issues as well. How do you explain the absolute lack of scientific basis for so much of done, for example, by the American Society of Pediatrics? And they're not the only medical institution that seems to have been, I'll use the word, corrupted over the last several years. I think that many of these medical institutions, I don't know where you are on this issue, losing sight of the biological definition of a man and a woman, or declaring, you know, and you did touch this in the book, that racism was a bigger public health crisis than COVID. Therefore, you can go protest in the streets. How do you explain? Explaining Democratic politicians is one thing. Explaining these previously very credible you would think science-based organizations is more difficult. How do you explain the American Academy of Pediatrics?
I think they've all been politicized. I mean, there was a study that just came out a day or two ago on masks and sort of declaring definitively that masks slow the spread of COVID. But I won't get into how the study did not actually show that. The most alarming element of the study, which I'm sure you've read, is that it also stated with no proof or support that masking would fight structural racism.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such an astonishing claim to put out there with no support. There were no, I mean, I don't know what kind of support you could provide, but to say something like that is such a woke virtue signal. It just says to me that all of these institutions have been taken over by woke politics. I don't know what to say. And they're all captured. I mean, they're also captured by pharma. Now I sound like a paranoid person, but it's true. I mean, we saw it with the opioid crisis, right? I mean, we saw that the FDA gave the Sacklers this non-addictive label. There was no study to support that. It's killed tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people because the institution was captured. In this case, not by wokeness, but by the pharmaceutical industry.
I don't think you sound conspiratorial or crazy. I think you're stating facts, and we should be able to state those facts. I mean, the role of big pharma in medical journals, the medical profession, in mainstream media, in advertising is undeniable. Big pharma is a massive power in informing and shaping our minds and our opinions. And to say so doesn't make you conspiratorial. But I want to go back now to your, I love that you said to me, and you corrected the record, I'm no longer a Democrat. Because look, your, again, from the first question I asked you, your conversion or your moment of truth, I find so very interesting on multiple levels, because one, it's a source of hope for me. But also, I'm not sure of the scope or the breadth of what you have changed your mind on. And so in the book, you do talk about, because it was wrapped up at the same time as COVID, the anti-racism movement, George Floyd. And you do have this fascinating exchange in the book where you talk about Chris Rufo. I'm sure many listeners or viewers are familiar with Chris Rufo, who has been someone who's fought against, for example, critical race theory, both at the corporate and educational level in America, where he asks you, hey, do you regret some of the things you did as brand president before COVID in advancing, I think one of them was, you know, race-affiliated support groups within Levi's. Where are you on how you see, I mean, did your sort of, like you said, you can't unsee the game when it comes to COVID. Did that remove the scales from your eyes in seeing, in my estimation, I think in Rufo's estimation as well, some of the game also being played when it comes to race?
Yeah, I mean, let's see. You call it a conversion, but I actually would say it slightly differently. I would say my values and principles have not actually changed. I always stood up for kids. I've been standing up for kids for 20 years. That didn't change. I sent my kids and do send my kids to public schools. I want them to be part of the community that we live in. I want them to be part of the diversity of the community, different views, different thoughts. Private schools would not provide them with that. So that's all I wanted. I wanted the same thing I always wanted. I think it's everybody else that revealed their hypocritical nature and colors. As far as the critical race theory, what I defend or what I walk through in the book, which thank you for reading, was the, and some of this, pardon me, I'm sorting through some of it. I'll just say that. The book is in large part, as you know, it's a memoir about being a woman in corporate America for the last 30 years, which hasn't always been easy. I'm not complaining. It's just not always been easy. I found great support from other women in the company in a non sort of formalized structure. There were very few female executives. Their encouragement meant a lot to me. So when I was asked to be the sponsor of the Black Employee Resource Group, and there were very few Black employees at corporate, I said, sure, because I support this idea of creating a sense of community by subgroups that fits into the larger culture of the company. What's wrong with that? It wasn't exclusionary. I was the executive sponsor. There were white members. There were Latino members. It was just really about creating this sense of community and some visibility for employees that perhaps weren't getting it. I don't have an issue with that. I do also see how it can go to a place that is not positive and is not about contributing to the larger goals of the company. It needs to be about a talent pipeline, about building the skill sets that contribute to the larger goals of the company, which, by the way, should be about making great product at a fair price and treating employees fairly. I still am okay with that. I would not have survived as long as I did at the company without the informal network of women in the company that I was able to sort of draw support from. To my mind, the employee resource groups, as we structured them, just sort of formalized that. I know that's not how they're structured in every company, but at ours, they were.
Okay, you've set up something.
Maybe not the answer you want.
No, I think it's an honest answer and one that I'm going to return to in a minute, because I've listened to you. I've listened to you lay out two visions on two very different subjects. And I'm not here to debate or tell you that you're wrong. But I think, as in all things in life, it's going to be the difficult part of our conversation, and maybe not. And the difficult part for all of us going forward is, where do we draw the line? But I want to come back to that. Okay. I want to sort of maybe end our conversation on, where do we draw the line when it comes to embracing, for example, you know, race selective support groups, or where do we draw the line on a brand being philosophically active? But before we do, I still want to stay on your story for a moment. Yeah. I'm really taken aback. I'm speaking of lines being crossed. I'm really taken aback at how difficult it was for you personally when it came to your family. It's the saddest part of this entire story. Tell me about that. And I think it's most notably about your brother, but I think it also at times about your father when it came to your husband as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the saddest part. It's hard to be separated from friends, but family is devastating. They disagreed with my views, you know, and sort of adopted the view or the stance that it was Trumpy and selfish and evil. And that's where I just go, am I allowed to curse?
What the, speak however you'd like.
Like, why can't we disagree? But I am not the incarnation of evil. I am very well reasoned and rational in what I am saying. I cited data. You can disagree with me. You can be recommending and adhere to a different sort of policy recommendation. But why do I become this sort of incarnation of evil because I disagree? And that's where it just becomes almost cult-like, that you have to sort of disconnect from family and friends that disagree with you. That's what's so problematic. And, you know, one of the things I write about in the book is it all kind of went to shit for me when I agreed to go on Laura Ingraham's show after trying to get on other shows. Me and a bunch of the grassroots group of parents that I was a part of, we knew that would be controversial, but that is when the employees just completely went berserk on me, because and many acknowledged she didn't say anything, she being me, that was wrong or that I disagree with necessarily. This is a year into the restrictions already, but it was who she said it to. You know, she consorted with the enemy, therefore she must be the enemy. And that is just such a absurd and toxic orientation. I will talk to anybody about this story. I'm happy to engage with people that disagree with me. I always learn something when I talk to people. And, you know, this next part of the conversation, maybe we disagree, but we see each other's point a little bit. But my family, not my parents, my dad was very critical, but he and I, as I say in the book, talked the whole time. I'd continue to send him articles. He was always willing to engage with me. He was a little meaner than I would have liked at times about my views and my husband's, but we're all good. I just went there, you know, a week ago. Everything's fine. But things with my brother are potentially fractured forever. It's really hard for me to see how we can get past it. The accusations, pitching reporters to write hit pieces on me.
Yeah, I saw that.
I mean, it was the most devastating moment for me of the last 2.5 years, because I disagreed on COVID policy and school closures. It doesn't make any sense.
All right, we're going to step aside here for just a moment. Stay tuned.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Yeah, anybody that does what I do, yeah. You know, you're used to whatever. People saying whatever, you know, and taking whatever it is you believe and attributing the most malevolent motives to you. And then even going even beyond that, making it even more simplistic, mm-hmm. like you just said, oh, you're a science denier. You want people to die. You don't care about your grandmother. You are evil incarnate. But it's one thing to hear that from, you know, some random account. Right. It's yeah. much more to hear from a person that you know. And by the way, you were hearing that because you were hearing that from your colleagues. I'll never forget, Jennifer. Look, I got a text after the horrific shooting in Uvalde. Right. Because, look, I'm a supporter of Second Amendment rights from a friend, a text from a friend, somehow attributing my point of view to this tragedy that somehow I am responsible for the deaths of these children. And that's it for me right there. Look, you know who I am as a person. You know, we're not anonymous to one another. And so,
yeah,
you know, this is what you think of me as a person. So I have a small bit of understanding of what it's like for someone like your brother to know who you are as a person and then to adopt the same type of mentality as a random account on Twitter and attribute all of that malevolence to you.
Yeah, that's well said. And I felt that with my peers at work. I felt that with some of my friends in San Francisco. You know the arc of my life. You know what I've done in my life. You know I'm not a stupid person. I don't take a stance lightly. You know that I would have educated myself. You know that I really care. Why are you attributing these malicious intentions? You can disagree without thinking, like I said, I am evil. But to know what's in my heart and the arc of my life, and that I'm not stupid, that my intellect got me here, even if you disagree, and two thoughtful, reasonable people can disagree on matters. I don't know. That's what makes me feel like it's gotten very culty. You know, Scientology furthers, I know it's a religion, it's kind of a cult, right? And it sort of furthers this, principle of disconnection. That's what they call it. You have to cut people out of your life that don't completely support Scientology because they are evil and they are bringing you down. That's what this was like. That's what I experienced because I stepped outside of the democratic orthodoxy. It doesn't matter now that I was right. It doesn't yeah. matter now. The attitude still to some extent is, yeah, but why did you say it? Why did you have to say it? Well, because kids were being harmed. And, you know, I had some experience here. When I wrote a book about gymnastics and exposing the cruelty in that culture, it was the same knee-jerk reaction. It was pre-Trump. It was 2008. And it was pre-Me Too. And so it was, you're a liar and a grifter and you're a loser. You were a terrible gymnast. And that's why you're saying these things, because you're bitter. It was all true. Everybody knows it now. Dr. Larry Nassar, who was the USA team gymnastics coach for 30 years, is in prison for life for sexually assaulting over 500 girls and women. If what you're saying is inconvenient, the mob, whatever cohort, will come for you. And it doesn't matter if what they say is true or not. They go for the most demonizing appellation possible. You know, and the point there is to shut other people up. That's why.
You achieved some redemption when it came to that gymnastic story. You said you went from heretic to celebrated heroine. Have you at this point? You're right. I mean, any person that has a cursory read in on COVID now understands. And I don't think it takes much. I think it takes a cursory read on COVID now should understand. Yeah. All of the horrendous mistakes that were made over that time period. And that's what you were pointing out. Have you had any redemption on COVID? Has anybody come back to you and said, either professionally or personally, or even online, have people come back to you and said, I'm sorry, you were right?
No, The short answer is no. I were all in on it, that it became sort of almost an identity, this sort of virtuousness of championing lockdowns and school closures. They will never admit it. In fact, the best you can get is, well, we were wrong, but for the right reasons. We were wrong, but we cared about people and wanted to save lives. Whereas you might have been right, but it was the wrong reasons. It's because you're selfish and wanted to get a haircut and a manicure or whatever they used to say. And that was sort of the theme, I think, that came through in that recent Atlantic piece about amnesty by by Emily Oster. And what does that even mean? You were right for the wrong reasons, so you're still an asshole? Basically, that's what they're saying.
You've mentioned this more than once now, and, you know, I like that you mention it. It's, you know, what's interesting is a lot of times when I have these conversations, I actually try to avoid talking about political parties. I don't do it successfully all the time. I talk about Democrat and Republican from time to time, but I'm a little more apt to say like left and right, because it's more attached to ideas. Yeah. Than is Democrat and Republican.
Party.
And I don't, sure. I don't know. I just don't like partisanship. I don't think it's a team sport necessarily. It should be an embodiment of ideas. And I want to attack and debate ideas. I don't want to draw lines in the sand about a team, but I think that it's necessary at times. And I think it's necessary to your story. And therefore it's accurate that several times you have brought up Democrat, because, I like how you point out in your story that at the highest levels of Levi's, meaning the CEO, and then beyond, the largest shareholders of Levi's as well, the Haas family, it's perfectly fine to make your political voice known. But it wasn't for you, even when it was divorced from a political party.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the family, as we call them, the Haas family, who are majority share owners of Levi's, are very intertwined with the Democratic, the actual party. So not left-leaning values, both, but actually with the Democratic Party.
Gavin Newsom, you point out, intricately tied to Gavin Newsom.
Yes, a family member actually works on his staff. Dan Goldman just ran for Congress and won in District 10 of New York using his windfall from the Levi's IPO. He outspent every other candidate combined by millions and millions of dollars. So, yes, intertwined, I think, more than I even realized, despite the fact that I'd been there for many, many years. And what got me in trouble there that was overtly political is I posted an article about the recall, the Gavin Newsom California recall, and he won decisively. I didn't even comment on it. Well, I just literally, it was like an excerpt from the article and a quote from a respectable, I don't even remember what publication. And I was told you shouldn't do that. You can't comment on this recall, which is such overt censorship of political speech. It's not like I was out there campaigning for another candidate, Larry Elder, whoever. I didn't even vote in the recall. I lived in Colorado already. And the reason was you can't, because the family connections to the Democratic Party. So let's play this out. What does that mean? If you're a Levi's employee in New York, can you not vote for a candidate that wasn't Dan Goldman? I mean, where does this end?
Do you think that your former colleagues would say to you, so for example, you also point out that your CEO donated to Mark Kelly, running for senator in Arizona, just did again, by the way, and just won, donated to Mark Kelly, Democrat senator. Do you think your former CEO, though, maybe even the Haas family, other parts of the family, like you mentioned, Dan Goldman, or even your colleagues at within the management of Levi's would have said to you, no, Jenna, you can contribute to whoever you want. You can cast your vote for whoever you want. You can donate money, just like Chip, our CEO, donates money to Mark Kelly. But you can't be out there on social media advocating for something that impacts the brand of Levi's.
Yeah, sure. That's what they'd say. First of all, it didn't impact the brand. I mean, we recovered. We came out of our sort of lockdown. All the stores closed. The brand recovered very quickly based on the strength of the brand. At no point did my voice advocating for children adversely impact the brand and our financial performance. That was what everyone kept saying, but there's a risk, and you're saying things that go against our stance. We didn't have a stance on schools and kids. How could I be saying something that went against the stance of the company? You know, now they're saying, well, of course we supported her on schools, which is a lie, but she went against public health officials. Well, it was public health officials advocating for schools to be closed. So that's a nonsensical statement. It all just, it's not even sort of, it's simpler, I think. I could sort of analyze the complexity of it all day long, but essentially I went against the Democratic orthodoxy in California, and that was unacceptable. All good people, all woke good Democrats stayed home to stay safe. And I said, no, 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 that's not the case. This is going to harm the children and the people that we say we care about. This is going to harm low-income children. This is going to harm Black and brown children who disproportionately attend public schools, which is exactly what happened, as we now know. But it all just became religious, the fervor around, I am a good, virtuous person because I can afford to stay home and order Uber Eats and watch Netflix and not really go to work on Zoom for a year and a half. It's sort of religious in nature, and that's why anyone who goes against it is considered a heretic and needs to be expelled, which is what happened to me.
Okay. As you know, we've met in person. We've been on television together before, and here we are sitting together for an extended period of time right now. Maybe I need to say this for the audience. I don't think I need to say it for you, but, you know, A, I appreciate your story, and B, I agree with almost every position that you've espoused today. But as is, I think something that you will appreciate, and as is required by me, let me see if I can now play devil's advocate in a few places and push you and see if we can find that line that I alluded to earlier. Okay, let's start with the race side of things. It would be my contention that it's an impossible line to draw. Like, first of all, when you start allowing for race-conscious affiliation groups, and I get what you're saying. You had the support of women because you had commonalities in rising up to the ranks of Levi's, and you wanted to extend that to other people who might be in similar situations. But I think that, and I don't want to speak for Chris Rufo or anyone else, but I think that when we as a society, culture, corporate America, or political America start embracing race as a way to self-segregate, I think, I don't know, Jen, if there's breaks. I don't know if there's breaks on that. You know, like, I sort of feel like once you get into first gear, it ends up where we are. And I think you would acknowledge where we are. You do in the book. You acknowledge where it went very quickly. You get to fifth gear really quickly. And then at that point, racism and anti-racism are the same thing. And so for me, then that one, that's a really difficult, beyond being an individual, making individual decisions, as any sort of group, as any sort of, you know, body, corporate or political body, I don't know if it's a possible line to draw.
I think that's I'm not going to argue with you necessarily. I am, as I told you, it was very difficult, you know, starting in corporate America in 1993, coming up as one of very few women to find community. And there's a whole chapter on the challenges that I faced as a woman in corporate America. And it's a testament to how much better things are now, honestly. And I position it that way. It is really a testament. Like, some of the things that I cite, I think people will go, God, that sounds like the dark ages, but it was totally normal. You know, naked chicken fights at sales meetings with topless assistants. Like, this is crazy. No one thinks that's okay. That was 20 years ago. That wasn't that long ago. It's good we don't think that's okay and allow for that anymore, right? I think it is. Mm-hmm. Your point is well taken. I think I have an easier time. I know what your second question is going to be. What's the line around woke capitalism? I think I have a firmer, really well thought through position on that. And your point is well taken. And, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm still thinking through it. As I state in the book,
that's okay.
I would never say, I still believe there is actual racism in the world. I don't know that you would disagree with me on that.
No, of course not.
But I would like to focus on actions that can help remedy it. That is why, and I go into some degree of detail on it, you know, all the anti-racism trainings that I went through at Levi's and that are happening across the country, where you're supposed to sort of get on your knees and you know, admit your privilege. What does this do? How does this help anyone? The single most structurally racist policy I can imagine that was implemented in the last 2 years was public school closures. So if I believe racism exists and I believe that Black children deserve just as much opportunity as wealthy white children, then I'm going to fight like hell to get the schools open. And then when they are open, to give those children equality of opportunity, to make sure those schools are just as good and give them that free and equal education that they deserve. That's where our focus should be, not on anti-racism training. So I didn't totally answer your question, but I'm
action-oriented. Not only did you answer it, I say bravo. I mean, however, I also know that it will fall short of, you know, I think society's expectations right now, because I share the same outlook. Look, you're not going to say it because I think you learned the hard way, as you laid out in your book. But you have your ex-husband is Black. You have, is it two or three mixed race children?
Two
mixed race children. You're not going to say it because you have learned the hard way that somehow that is you commandeering the microphone in this conversation as a white woman. But I have been somebody, whether or not it was in sports media or in political media and news, that says, look, I just want to focus on the individuals and actions and making people's lives better. But that's not what today is required of you. What's required of you today is to yell racist at any and everything possible. And somehow in that process, you can prove that you are not racist. And I believe that, anti-racism is indistinguishable from racism, to be quite honest. I think they are one in the same.
I think when you flatten people into categories, right, that is racism. When you flatten any group into a set of characteristics, in the past and possibly still to some extent, that happens with Black folks. And now we're doing that. And I felt it very much in the anti-racism training with, white women like me. I was told we're the problem. We don't want to give up our privilege. We were just flattened into this caricature, we being white women. Yes, I would agree with you. When you don't look at the individual as a person, when you just sort of assume certain things about their character and who they are because of how they look, we get into very dangerous territory.
All right, we're going to step aside here for just a moment. Stay tuned.
So I want to talk about brand now. And I told you this when we were in the green room together at Fox. I don't know how instructive it is, but I didn't tell you this part of my relationship, my story with Levi's when we were together. And the reason I, for the audience listening, say my story is because that was a big marketing campaign that you championed of people saying and revealing their story with Levi's. I wore Levi's 517 and then 527s for, gosh, decades, because I wore cowboy boots and I was always looking for something that fit over cowboy boots. And I had to have been, along with most of my buddies, like whatever you categorize your customers as, like most loyal, I was in that group. And I had two complaints about Levi's. One is that you always had to go to the store and grab like a stack of five or six in your size. And then see which ones fit right, because they were not consistent. So I could get like five pairs of 32, 34s and they all fit differently. But my second was, and you said this was the like low point of Levi's marketing, and this is the part I didn't tell you, was that Go Forth campaign. That Go Forth campaign that was like the beginning of, is Levi's political? Does Levi's represent me? And you guys didn't, in those ads, I don't remember you taking overtly political stances. It was revolutionary. I think there was one with a guy with a Molotov cocktail throwing it, on the streets. And it felt like...
To be clear, I didn't do that. You know that.
Okay.
That was not my...
But that's my... Hey, that's the difference. I don't wear Levi's anymore. And it wasn't like I never had a I'm done with Levi's moment. It just slowly kind of broke apart until I found things that I felt like fit me better as a brand and fit me literally better in the seat.
Yeah, that was a low point. I was not responsible for that campaign. In fact, that campaign, which I hated also, it was just dark and dreary and nobody wants to look like that. And it was the reason, I think, that I ultimately became the chief marketing officer, because our CEO hated it too. And he felt we had more of an aligned vision on what would get the brand back on track. The other issue with that campaign is it wasn't there was no real product in it. Like, people want to know what the jeans look like. They want to know that they're going to fit their butt. Women want to know their butt's going to look cute. It did none of that. It was just grungy, dirty looking people seeming very angry and not having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And for the most part, people also do have fun in jeans, or at least we try to, right? So that campaign was, it's interesting, that's when you left the brand. It did get more fun a little bit after that. It's when I sort of stepped in and uncovered this insight, which is people said, I live my life in Levi's. I wear other things, but I live my life. And a lot of the stuff they told us was fun stuff, you know, cross-country backpacking. I met my girlfriend, like whatever it is. I danced in them. I partied in them. I went to music festivals. People have experiences in their jeans and they come to fit their body over time perfectly. And they love them and they keep them forever. So I wanted it to be fun again. And I wanted also to put the spotlight back on the product and away from all the dreariness.
It's funny you say keep them forever. I could go upstairs right now and I bet I have 10 pairs of 527s that are all worn out. I can't wear them anymore, but there's like memories in all the holes and memories and all the, you know,
I wore
these on a ranch in Montana and all this is from bucking bales of hay. Yeah. Oh, I mean, jeans are Americana. And that's the thing. Okay. So now this is what I want to do with you. And again, it's not a debate because I don't know the right answer on this. Okay. Where do we draw the line on brands separating themselves from their employees? I remember when I was at ESPN and Colin Kaepernick takes a knee during the national anthem for the NFL. I said, it is perfectly acceptable for the NFL to say, not on our dime. Not on our time. And I said, and I believe to this day, you don't go to the grocery store or to Walmart and expect on the other end of the spectrum to see the checkout clerk wearing a Make America Great Again hat. It's okay for Walmart or that grocery store to say no. You think, and by the way, let's keep building this out. For example, one of my former colleagues at ESPN, Jemele Hill, would tweet about President Trump and it got her in trouble. Okay. And I think she would make the argument that I anticipate you will make. I didn't do that in the capacity of my job. I did that in my personal life. Do you distinguish yourself from any of those examples I just gave because you could draw a line between your personal life and your professional life?
Well, I think that's where it's complex, you know, and I was deeply immersed in the Kaepernick thing. He played at Levi's Stadium at the time. We were all trying to figure out, oh, what do we do in this situation? I think, where companies should draw a line, let's take the individuals out for a second. I think companies should draw a line as far as policies that impact employees, like those ones that I cited earlier. I think those are good policies, policies that extend more equality to more employees, giving, you know, LGBTQ employees healthcare benefits in 1992 before marriage equality was a thing. They didn't take them away from married employees. They just gave them to more employees. That extends equality. I think when it crosses over into the external world and you're championing policies that don't really have much to do with how you lead an organization, but does probably have a lot to do with alienating some consumers and, by the way, alienating some employees. They won't say it because they're afraid if they say it, they'll get fired. That's where the line is for me. And that's kind of a hard line in the sand.
A good example of that Disney then? Disney getting politically active in Florida or the NBA pulling its All-Star game out of North Carolina. And their excuse, what they will say is, this impacts our employees. But they're definitely going outside the walls to get involved in the political process.
Yeah, I'll use Netflix as an example, and this is a CEO that I do think did the right thing and showed a little bit of courage and wasn't afraid if his kids were mad at him. You know, there was the big protest about Chappelle's show, the closer being anti-trans, and all these thousands of employees were supposed to protest, and I think about 23 showed up, and everybody was angry. He wasn't taking it off the platform. He said, "This is a business. We have all kinds of content. All kinds of people watch Netflix. If you don't like it, then maybe don't work here." And that was it. That was it. Did they leave in mass? I don't think so. And so in a sense, that was a real business choice. He depoliticized it by making a business choice. He said a lot of people want to watch a lot of different things. And the CEO of Spotify did the same thing with Rogan. He said, "No, people like it. They want to listen. We have a lot of different kinds of content. Leave us alone." And then it was fine. those are business decisions. I think it's complicated to your point when it gets to the individual. And some have argued, well, you were the president, you weren't just any employee. But I sort of reject that. So if you're more successful, you have fewer rights. And do you really think that an employee, I was well-liked and influential. Do you think an employee that maybe was a lower level that without the influence I had would be granted a different, I think we have to be able to retain our right to speak up about the things that we care about. I never commented on a Levi's policy. That to me would have been grounds for dismissal. I never said Levi's vaccine mandate policy is evil. As a leader in the company and an officer of the company, I think that would be grounds for dismissal. I did not say that.
So,
I said toddlers shouldn't wear masks preschool.
Right. Which, again, I don't know why that's so controversial. Back to the woke capitalism thing on the line. You said a minute ago you were anticipating me going down this path and you have a firmer idea on where that is. But so what was the name of the shoes that, like, you buy a pair of shoes and we give back a certain amount, or we give a free pair to kids?
Toms.
What was the name?
Toms.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that woke capitalism? How do you see that? Is that woke capitalism? Because I think what you're talking about is companies doing things beyond being honest about the purpose of their business, which is at Levi's to sell jeans and make money, at Netflix to put out content and make money. You know, or is Todd's Tom's honest about it in a way that you respect? I don't know where we draw that.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think it's the dishonesty, the cover, the pose of being sort of woke do-gooders, but in reality not being really, that I take issue with.
Yeah.
I think if a company is willing to make a real sacrifice because of the stand that they take, I support it. That's their choice. They can choose to do that. It's when it's a pose and when it's fake, you know.
Yes.
That's what I take issue with. So, you know, Patagonia is very environmental, very woke, sold it. You know, the guy recently, what's his name? Yvon Chouinard. He sold the company and he basically sold it to NGOs and said all of the money and the profits going forward would go to these environmental NGOs. He gave up all that money. If that's what he wants to do, that's an honest decision. I don't think it's honest in the way my company practiced it. I don't think it's honest in the way Nike practiced it. You know, I use an example in the book with Nike where they make a big show about Women's History Month and celebrating all women, and yet they treat women inside the company. And there have been several high-profile news stories on this. At the same time, they're doing that and making a show of women's equality. They're treating the women inside the company horribly. They're harassing them. You know, the runners in their Oregon Running Project were abused to the point of suicidality, and pregnant athlete endorsers weren't paid. So I that's what I reject, is the artificial pose of wokeness.
Yeah. You know, I'm just sitting here. And I didn't even know where that part of this conversation would go, Jim, but I think it's actually going to be the place where we can end the conversation, because I'm just sorting through this myself out loud, because I don't know. I asked those questions in complete earnestness to you about where that line lies, because, again, not to choose the easy path, I don't know that you can draw that line, right? On when you're active or when you're about something more than simply selling jeans. But what we can expect, and I'm not even sure we can expect them to be fair, like CEO versus you being politically active or having a voice. But what we can ask for is honesty. Don't pretend you want my business if you hate my viewpoints and you don't even allow people who share my viewpoints to work at your organization.
That's right.
Right. And so I think that's a minimum level of expectation, I think, that we can have here. Like, just tell us who you are. You're right. Patagonia tells us who they are. Tom's tells us who they are. Levi's, if this is who you are, if Disney, this is who you are, then quit pretending to be something else and trying to sucker me out of my dollars.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I think the irony in all of this, in my particular story, is the issue I which isn't necessarily what you were just talking about, but the issue, this is the problem. The issue that I stood up on and wouldn't stop speaking out on should never have been political in the first place. If there's one thing that everybody should be able to agree on, it's about the health and development and well-being of our children. How can we not agree on that? We might have slightly different sort of ideas about how we get there. We might believe in school choice or not, but do we actually believe children should be isolated alone and not receiving any education at all? I don't think anybody would say they believe that. So the idea that this got so politicized is bonkers. And the idea that anyone who spoke out was demonized, therefore others were silenced, is why I keep talking about this. Because when that happens and a consensus is manufactured, because that's what it was manufactured by silencing dissenters, we reach very poor decisions. We just do. It's propaganda, and we don't have the right discussions to get to good decisions. And that's so dangerous. So that's why I don't stop talking about it.
Well, okay, so here's my takeaway in the end. This is how I'm processing this. Like, again, distinguishing what Levi's was, and it wasn't just Levi's. I mean, it was Levi's, as told through your story, but it was everybody. It was bereft of leadership. It wasn't a clear voice about who we are. It was following. It was following the consensus, even when the consensus is wrong, to your point. So you don't have a vision, Levi's, of who you are. You're just waiting for the consensus to tell you who you are. And then secondarily, if honesty is all we ask, then I'll say this, Jen, that's why it is so good that you continue to speak. It's why it's good that you didn't take the $1 million buyout. It's good that you wrote the book, because you're the only one willing to say what Levi's won't say about itself, you know, to be honest about who Levi's is.
They can't. No one's going to say it or admit it about themselves. I mean, the school closure zealots won't even admit at this point that they were the ones that closed the schools. They just act, you know, once you're all in, you can't really call the mea culpa. You just go in even further on bad decisions. And I do think that if enough people start to speak up, it's going to have to reverse course. I think we're going to have to get back to some sort of willingness to listen to each other, to some sort of normie capitalism, as I call it in the book, because the fact is Levi's doesn't want to alienate 50% of American consumers. They don't actually want to. That would be crippling for the business. And so we're going to, and there's a way to do it. Just talk about the product. Just talk about the product and how great you're going to look in it, and treat employees fairly. That's my other issue with all of this. Just if I could say one last time, it's a cover, and even the employees buy it. There was nothing woke about laying off 15% of the workforce and collecting $42 million within the same time frame, which is what the CEO did. That is not caring. That is not empathetic. But there's a big, like, look over here, we care, while acting like you don't. That is what I reject. That's what I reject.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. Jen, I've been impressed with you every time we've had a chance to speak. And I'm really glad you gave us this time today. I think everyone should go check out Levi's Unbuttoned. It's a good story about what was happening in corporate America in the years 2020 through 2022. And the way I think a lot of this runs. I think we know it when it comes to society, and we're familiar with it when it comes to politics, but it's a good insight into the way it plays out in corporate America. I've really enjoyed this, Jen. Thanks for being on with me today.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for the conversation. Thanks for reading. You read so carefully. You read the book very carefully.
I read the whole thing. Yes. And I really liked
it. Thank you.
So I don't say that gratuitously. Thank you, Jen. There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jennifer Say. Again, go get her book, Levi's Unbuttoned, out wherever you buy your books right now. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.